welcome to Observations. I'm here with Kirk. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Good. I couldn't help but noticing, particularly with the weather going wacky here, we've got our, what's it, the fifth hurricane now that's ravaging North America. This one, Maria. And having just devastated Puerto Rico, I guess Puerto Rico is going to be 6 months without electricity.
That's what they're predicting. Wow.
Yeah, and of course, that was after Harvey did $15 billion worth of damage in Texas, and then you got another $5 to $10 billion with Irma and in Florida, and now you have Maria. And Jose was hanging around there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Pope came out and said, well, you know, the all of this is a direct result of global warming, and you got to be an idiot if you don't believe in climate change. You ain't got to be an idiot if you believe in Roman Catholicism. As for climate change, that doesn't take much belief. All I have to do is observe the weather 2 days in a row, and it changed. You know, we are in a warming period. We began a warming period around 1850. The Earth has gone through these anywhere from a minimum of 300-year cycles, a phase of a 600-year cycle, to a 600-year phase of the 1200-year cycle. But it's extraordinarily well known in the scientific community that that for the last several million years, the Earth has warmed and cooled over a period of averaging about 600 years for each of those cycles, and we began the warming cycle around 1850. So the Earth is getting warmer. It'll continue to get warmer. Those things are not going to have any kind of a devastating effect because man's going to mess up this planet big time here over the next 15 years, and so we really don't have to worry so much about man-made contribution to climate change. But in the midst of all that, there's an announcement that I read just a moment ago that VW is securing cobalt supplies so that it can transition to a fleet of electric cars. And one of the things that's always just struck me about electric cars, they call them zero emissions, is that do they think that the electricity for those cars grows on trees?
They must, because they're power plants, and I don't know if you're going to get them all out of a windmill. That's
well, good. You know, the problem is that the environmentalists, the climate change people, don't want you to build a windmills because they think they're obtrusive to the environment. Of course, they're known to occasionally kill a bird or two.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you to, and they are ugly. I mean, I'm here to tell you, I agree with that. But they don't want you to build wind turbines, and wind turbines have lots of issues. They're not all that efficient. There's too many issues related to the blades. And they don't want you to dam rivers, because even though hydroelectric is the cleanest and cheapest form of electricity, they don't want you to build more nuclear plants, even though we have nuclear plants now, that run on the daughter products or the byproducts of a first phase nuclear generating plant. So you can consume
the waste
and generate electricity consuming the waste the way that the new plants are designed. But no, they're about control. They've never been about the environment. They just use the environment as as their god to impose laws that must be obeyed. Their Torah, if you will, and I mean that in the Talmud sense of Torah, and
right.
Yeah, and so you know you've got fossil fuels, what's called fossil fuels, natural gas, coal, and oil, to generate power because no one will allow anything else, and so I just want to know what is the benefit of an electric car? You're using the same fuels to propel them.
That's a very good question. Can they run them on natural gas?
That would be actually more efficient, is to run the car on natural gas rather than using the natural gas to generate the power that then is distributed through the that system to recharge your batteries. Yeah, absolutely. Now the problem with running a car on natural gas is that it has to be kept under pressure. And because, you know, it is a gas, where gasoline really isn't a gas, it's a liquid. And, you know, everything has a phase that is solid, liquid, and gas. But at ambient temperatures, gasoline is a liquid, where natural gas at ambient temperatures is a gas, and therefore it has to be pressurized. And that's not only expensive, but if you go, it can go boom. It's kind of like the hydrogen cars. You can run a fuel cell on a hydrogen car, but you better not get an open flame near that sucker.
Yeah, then you become the Hindenburg.
You become the Hindenburg. So there's issues all around with this sort of thing. I do want to mention though one thing. I have joked in the past that North Korea has a childish dictator. I've called him the fat bad hair boy, as opposed to using his name, and in a mocking way. But I'm not the president of the United States. I do not have a military that's going to respond to what I have to say. And my the only reason I ever bring him up is to say that the only proper response to a likely insane individual, a mentally disturbed individual, is to leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said that because the Trumpster has, right from the beginning, well, actually, initially, while he was running for office, he was, you know, he was going to cut a great deal with everybody, and he was going to meet Fat Bad Hair Boy and cut a great deal with him. Well, that didn't turn out to be the case. So he's now calling him Rocket Man, and said that he is going to, if Rocket Man doesn't obey, he's going to annihilate North Korea. Now, the President of the United States doesn't say, I'm going to annihilate another country. The only people that I've known that say that kind of stuff are Muslim nations relative to Israel. But the President of the United States, after calling him Rocket Man, said he's going to annihilate North Korea if Rocket Man doesn't behave. Do you know what that does to an insane individual?
It's the situation, to say the least.
Oh, my God. And how can America have elected a man as president who has that little self-control, who is that unaware of the kind of thing that exacerbates a problem? And we're not talking about, you know, I've gotten into debates with people, and if they go ballistic, they're going to cuss and scream.
Mm-hmm.
If Rocket Man, to use the Trumpster's name, goes ballistic,
he might shoot off one of his rockets.
With a nuclear bomb on the top of it.
Mm-hmm. And even if he misses or can't get here.
Nuclear bombs are like horseshoes, you know, close counts.
Those, yeah, horseshoes, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we need.
In the hell does he think he's doing? I am not only stunned, and I think this is, I read an article the other day that, you know, said that one of the ways that the news media got the election all wrong is they could not even fathom that America could elect someone like Donald Trump. I may be with him now. I'm just flabbergasted that we could have done so. Everything you look at in this regard. Now, I will tell you that the one place where I agree with him to about 1% is on the whole Russian issue, where he is all and he wants to call it fake news, that the Russian thing is fake news. The reality is that the Russians most likely did try to influence the American election. So my question to you would be, so what?
Yeah, didn't we do that to Allende and Castro and everybody else?
The CIA's primary purpose for about 30 years was to influence other governments, to destabilize regimes and to influence elections. I mean, that's what we use them for. How in the world can the United States complain that a foreign country tried to interfere with the U.S. election? And there is no indication that what Russia did was even illegal. The only thing that they've come up with so far is that they had accounts on Twitter and accounts on Facebook, and that their Facebook accounts generated stories that Americans were too stupid to realize were fake. Now, whose fault is that? And why is using a social media to disseminate your agenda all of a sudden a international crime?
Well, we used to have free speech, so, I mean, you should do it regardless. You should have sense enough to go, that's ridiculous.
So, you know, free speech means that you are free to lie.
Mm-hmm. It does.
You are free to deceive.
Otherwise, the Christian churches would have to shut down.
You know, if you want to shut down everything that's deceitful, yeah, you'd have to shut down Christianity, Islam, socialist secular humanism. You have to shut them all down.
Yeah.
You have to shut down. You know, I read in an article yesterday that's related. The NSA has come up with some very sophisticated new encryption technologies, and it wants the world at large to adapt and adopt its new encryption technologies. And encryption technology is to keep data encrypted and therefore secure from hackers. Do you know what the entire world told the United States?
Go jump off a cliff.
Absolutely. We don't care how good your new encryption is. We don't trust you. We think that the only reason that you're offering new encryption technology is, A, because you know how to break the encryption, and therefore every conversation we have, you'll be spying on. And, B, you probably have code embedded in your encryption that will give you a backdoor to our entire security apparatus. So, no. That's what Germany said. That's what the U.K. said. Well, I'm not sure the U.K. said it. France said it. Mm-hmm. The U.K. and the United States are in lockstep as it relates to intelligence or lack thereof. That's even what Israel said. No, thank you very much. Go away. We don't trust you. And as a matter of fact, the news media, was New York Times, said it was scores of countries that told the United States, we don't trust you. Now, isn't that amazing that the United States thinks that, you know, that the most noble country on earth, and here's the world collectively saying, we don't trust you. If you're not trustworthy as a nation, what do you have?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Or any relationship.
You know, the fat, bad hair boy said that, you know, when Trump went ballistic and said he was going to annihilate North Korea if they didn't obey him, his comment was, it just demonstrates that the United States can't be trusted, that this man's not qualified to be the chief and of the military of the most powerful nation. It proves that my strategy of protecting our country by developing a nuclear program was correct.
Yeah. I think the Iranians can say the same thing for that reason.
Exactly.
He's been overthrown, but I mean, remember, we took them over, and then we ousted him. And
the best motivation for Fat Bad Hair Boy is Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
We demanded that Iraq give up its weapons of mass destruction, all of which, by the way, we gave them. We gave them the chemical, biological weapons for them to fight the Iranians, and we gave him the nuclear know-how that he had up to the point that he had it anyway, because we had the Atoms for Peace program, and that also gave Tehran a nuclear power plant and the fuel for it.
Yeah.
We gave it to him, and then we demanded that he give it up, which he did. And then what did we do once he gave it up?
Well, then we overthrew him.
Yeah, we lied about the fact that we were going to invade because he still had them. We invaded, killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And finally had to admit, oh, maybe we were wrong. He did give them up.
Yeah.
And so if you're a fat, bad hair boy, are you going to give up your nuclear program, knowing what the United States did to Saddam? Would you trust the United States?
Of course not. Neither
will
Syria, neither will Russia, neither will Europe.
No. So anyway, that's enough news for today. One last thing. Go ahead,
and
please.
Last time we spoke, they hadn't said who the bomber was in London, and of course now we know it is a Muslim terrorist.
You know, when we spoke last, I had told you that there's something that I don't very often do.
Mm-hmm.
When a bombing occurs, a terrorist act occurs, until such time as there is a declaration of who did it,
mm-hmm.
I don't speculate and I don't attribute it to Islamic terrorism until such time as the perpetrator is identified. I make one exception on that. And the exception was the kind of thing that happened a week ago in London, if it's a backpack bomb, you know, loaded with shrapnel, and it kills not only innocent people, but people wholly unknown to the perpetrator. There's only one
motive, yeah.
Yeah, one motive. There's one group of people that are sick enough, disturbed enough, mentally deranged enough, collectively, to not only do that kind of thing, but to celebrate it. And you have to be so upside down, you're worshiping Satan as your God, to be that perverted. And so I said a week ago, before they announced that it was, in fact, a Muslim who perpetrated it, that based upon the target and the tactic, the likelihood is 99.9% or greater that this was a Muslim. Turned out to be.
Yeah.
Wasn't hard to call that one, was it?
No, I was there, but sure
yeah.
enough.
Yeah. Speaking of challenging to call, if you were looking at the moon phase, you could have astronomically chosen to celebrate Tarua 2 nights ago, beginning 2 nights ago, with the sunset 2 nights ago. There was a 0.3% renewal of light on the moon's surface at moonset, which was about an hour after sunset. So you'd still be looking into the brightness of the western horizon within an hour of the time that the sun set, and you'd have to pick up within that bright sky a 0.3% of a light on the emerging on the moon's surface. My eyes aren't that good.
No.
Now, if I'm ascribing something to Yahweh, I might say, you know, God might well call it on this day, because astronomically that is the perfect definition of light renewing at the start of the day, which is at sunset. But I'm typically, since being a flawed guy, I have a different standard. My standard is it's got to be 1% or more of light on the moon's surface prior to within an hour of sunset, and it was not. So I started celebrating Tarua last night, but. So today is Tarua, and will be until sunset. And we're going to talk a little bit about the timing of Tarua here in a moment. But I had a friend that wrote me the other day, and you know, he says, "When are you going to observe Tarua?" And I said, "Realistically, I observe Tarua 6 days a week.
Truly.
Tarua is kind of defined my life for the last 15 or so years.
Everything is filtered through this event.
Right. I mean, our conversation about politics and warmongering and religion here getting into this program, that's half a teruah. You know, half a teruah is warning people about the things of man that are leading them away from God, that are deceiving them. That's half of teruah.
Yes.
And the other half of teruah is telling people what God is offering them and how to capitalize upon it, how to come to know him and engage in a relationship with him. So our lives are consumed with the whole notion of what teruah represents. Yours, mine, and so many others of ours. In fact, I think truly that once you become part of the covenant family, you you begin a personal teruah, which is that you really ought not be saying very much when you first join the covenant family. You can talk to other covenant members, but you ought not tell a lot of other people because you're just not prepared to answer their questions, present who Yahweh is, and how you engage in a relationship with him as convincingly, as accurately, perhaps as you should. I mean, because nobody starts fully developed. You start as a baby in this voyage of discovery. And so, and if somebody asks you an objection, you got no chance in the world of answering it. I mean, I remember so many times that people were just beginning to awaken to this would say, you know, I presented this to, you know, my husband or my wife or my best friend or a pastor, and they said, well, then you know, why did Jesus say he with the first sin cast no stone, judge not lest you. I mean, they'll throw out something. And you say, why did he say, upon this rock I'll build my church? Why is there a New Testament? Why do we have the New Testament of my blood in Luke? You know, doesn't it say that the New Testament will be unlike the Old Testament in Jeremiah 31? You know, they'll throw out something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, once you get into, you know, any of them, including this, the notion, didn't Peter say that Paul's letters were scripture? And if you address any of those concerns based upon being educated, having studied what Yahweh said, and because of teruah, also studying what man claims, you can not only disqualify the defense of Christianity, prove that it's absolutely ridiculous, but you can take every one of those arguments and show how the argument to prove Christianity actually disproves it. Now, for example, Peter's comments, his name is really Shimon Kefish, but Shimon's comments, and in fact his real name is Shimon ben Yochanan, is his name. What his letter says is that Paul's letters use circular reasoning, that they're based on the sophists, which are, you know, that's the Gnostic thought process, which is true, and that they do use circular reasoning, and that if you're not careful, they will lead you to your doom. You know, in fact, Paul's comments on Peter's comments on Paul's letters are so critical, so demeaning, so condescending that, you know, the likes of Calvin said, you know, we got to take Peter, we got to take that book out of here because that book destroys the credibility of the author of half the Christian New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter which argument they bring, you know the answer. You know, if they say, but Jesus fulfilled the Torah, so, you know, it's been done away with. Hey, have you ever read what he says? After saying that he came to fulfill it, when fulfill, by the way, means you honor the promise.
Mm-hmm.
You do what you've promised. Do you ever read what he said next? Well, no, what'd he say? Well, you don't want to know, do you? No, I really don't. Look, but of course, what he said is, don't think that I came to annul it. Don't think that I came to do away with it.
And wind you know? Tittle.
Yeah, every stroke of, and every letter, and every stroke that's written of those Hebrew letters that are written in the Torah, none of them shall be annulled or done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist. You know, it's so the concept of teruah is you start out as a consumer, as somebody who is on a personal teruah where it's your responsibility to educate yourself,
mm-hmm.
to grow. And that growth requires two things. You have to know what not to trust, and you need to know what to trust. You know, it was, after all, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're both there. Yeah, you you can't make a good decision unless you know both sides of the argument.
Right.
And so that's the whole requirement, really, if you will, of being a good child in the covenant family is coming to know and to then expose and condemn that which is wrong and counterproductive and come to know and espouse that which is beneficial.
Yeah.
And so that's the personal trip.
A lot of preparation, but it's, obviously it's well worth it, but it should be a most fascinating trip for anyone.
In right.
The covenant to begin with, you just go, wow.
Yeah, I think I sent you an email from a guy that's he's retired military. He was writing and saying that he first contacted me back in the days of Prophet of Doom and Tea with Terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And he then continued to read, and he says, you know, the arguments you made against Christianity are so overwhelming and so undeniable, I've stopped being a Christian. But, you know, I really want to go the next step and to get to know Yahweh. But there's just no way I can process all this Hebrew. And he said, you know, you're the prophet. You're speaking for God here. Why don't you give me the shortened version?
Yeah.
I'm sure you read that letter I sent you.
Oh, yeah.
CC'd you on it, and of course they.
You gave the proper response. Yeah.
Yeah. They. He needs to go on his own personal teruah.
Mm-hmm.
And on my comments to him were, first of all, don't sell yourself short. There are lots of free tools online that enable you to begin by just verifying that my translations are accurate.
Yeah, just examine some of the key words that give you trouble.
Right,
that
right.
Stick out.
Right.
Start there.
Right. Start there. And then from there, you know, after you've developed a foundation and you're confident that these translations are accurate, then go do your own. It's not hard. Don't sell yourself short. But don't sell me long either.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't be. I said it nicely, but please don't be calling me a prophet.
Prophets, yeah.
Yeah, you know, going back to the news for a moment, Trump, it was an article here about Trump, and it says the international leaders have realized that just Trump craves praise, has to be praised. And, you know, I thought about that for a moment. I said, you know, praise is really the single most destructive thing that a person can desire. We ought not solicit praise. And, you know, every time that someone has tried to say, well, you're a prophet or I'm only here because of what you do. The moment you get into a mode where you say, well, I must be special or accepting praise, you're through. You're through. You're absolutely useless. You know, it becomes an addiction, like it's heroin to the individual who needs it, who craves it. The best thing you could possibly say is, no. Come on. We're all in the same boat here. We're all trying to learn, to understand, and we want to share what we have come to discover. So I said, you know, don't be calling me a prophet. There's a huge difference between being a prophet and somebody who observes, closely examines and carefully considers what the prophets revealed on behalf of Yahweh.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you, and I got a letter from This is all regarding Tarua, in my view, by the way, because the whole nature of Tarua, we have to learn. That's why Shabua precedes Tarua. Shabua is about being enriched, empowered, and enlightened. And so you have to Tarua, you have to Shabua before you can Tarua. And you know what? Roy's comment, he was commenting on something I'd written in an earlier chapter. He said, you know, we may give the prophets too much credit. Now, let's pull two prophets out of the mix. I don't think we give Moshe too much credit because Devarim is in Moshe's words.
Uh-huh.
So for him to have conveyed Devarim, which is, Yosha quoted Devarim more than any other book in the Torah. So we're going to give Moshe credit for not only hearing what Yahweh had to say, being able to process it, understand it, and then share it in a meaningful way.
Yeah, he was a real deal.
He was a real deal. He understood. He made the transition between, this is what Yahweh said, I know it, to understanding it. And, of course, Dod is the king of understanding.
Sure.
But what he said is that it's very possible that the other prophets, and we're doing mostly Yashaya, it's possible that Yashaya did not understand what he heard or what he was saying.
Well, that's been the old argument for years because they are talking about a time that even if they see it in the vision, it's very hard to grasp it and put it in. It's just if you went into the future and saw what they saw, my gosh, that would be so
right.
Shocking to them.
Yes, and they'd have to use a vocabulary relative to a period 2,700 years ago to describe it. But when we examine the various breadth of the words that Yahweh is using, like I'm translating Yeshayah, the end of Yeshayah 7 right now, and, you know, if you read the English Bibles, the verse I just translated, God's going to get out a big old razor, and he's going to shave the heads and the feet of people, the head and the feet of people. And then he's going to sweep away the whiskers of the beard. I don't see God doing that.
No.
And so but that's what the words say if you just want to go superficial. And so you've got to take the time and say, okay, what is the root of these words? What are they related to? What else can they mean? And is he talking in such a way that says, listen, there is no way that anybody's going to understand what I'm saying here for another 2,700 years. But once they have the tools, they'll figure it out. And I think that to a large degree, there's things that prophets heard and they wrote down. And I was like, well, I'm not sure I understand that. But all right, I was told to say it. I'm going to say it. Not my job. Not my job to play editor here.
Yeah.
And that really is our challenge, is to go beyond knowing to understanding, and once we understand, we ought to engage in Tarua.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing we were going to talk about is the timing of Tarua.
Okay.
There's no question that Tarua is the first day of the seventh month, and we know how to establish the first month, so just seven moon phases from the beginning of the year, and the year begins. What is in effect the renewal of the moon's light in Abib, which is in the spring. So it's the first sliver of light on the moon closest to the vernal equinox. It's described as the time when the barley is the kernel is in the plant and it's still green and growing. And the flax flowers, blue flower on the flax. Now, that's the timing each year. And we know something that the next Mikra to be fulfilled is on Tarua.
Right.
I saw a show, was on, I think it was HBO, that was called The Sign. And they were trying to say, well, 2017 is going to be, you know, the great return of God or something of that nature. And they said, well, the way we know that is because there's a bunch of sevens in the important events related to Israel. You know,
<That's pretty> cool.
Now, there was a 67 war, but, you know, they said, well, in 47, Israel was reestablished. I think it was actually 48.
Yeah, but don't use it, Kelly.
Yeah, it was 48.
But never mind. I'm sorry.
But by the way, yeah, God does not establish his timing based upon actions of the United Nations
mm-hmm.
or based upon actions of armies.
Right.
So, no. Nothing is going to happen on 2017. And he says, and we also know that 2017 is a jubilee year. Say what?
Huh?
How is 2017 a jubilee year? I don't know. Anyway, the thing that is interesting here is that Yahweh has fulfilled, and they have no clue whatsoever. If you want to figure out God's timing, you have to follow the Mikra.
Yeah, you got to get a couple of points.
Yahweh told us that the first of the Mikra would be fulfilled in the fourth day of human history, which is year 4000 Yah.
Yeah, right.
And year 4000 Yah is 33 CE in our pagan calendars, and that is when Yahweh said the greater light will become visible as a sign of the meetings, the Moed, and they are Moed Mikra. Yosha. The diminished manifestation of Yahweh came, and in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE, a Yobel year, by the way, he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim, and the set-apart spirit fulfilled Shabuah. The first four Mikra were fulfilled in order in year 4000 Yah. They were all fulfilled in that year, in year 4000 Yah, because they are the means to the benefits of the covenant. You cannot, God cannot ascribe the benefits of the covenant without having fulfilled and honored his promise on Pesach to perfect, to make us immortal, Pesach to make us immortal, Matzah, which is integrated into Pesach to make us perfect, Bukkudim, which is to make us firstborn children into his covenant family for him to adopt us, and then Shabuah, which we mentioned, which is to enlighten, enrich, and empower us. So those are the first four Mikra.
Mm-hmm.
There is seven Mikra, aren't there?
Yes, sir.
There are seven Mikra. So the fifth Mikra is the next one to be fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
What is the fifth Mikra?
That's Teruah.
Teruah, son of a gun, Teruah. Okay, so Teruah is the next one to be fulfilled. We know the date that Yom Kippurim, which is the Day of Reconciliations, which is reconciling the relationship between Yahweh and Yisrael, and Yisrael and Yahuda. And by the way, Yom Kippurim, which is the day that he's going to return, has nothing to do with the church. As a matter of fact, the church will be annihilated.
No, it won't be any. You lost.
I came to the conclusion as I was translating these last few chapters. In fact, you made a note of it in our last program.
Yes.
That if it wasn't for the promises that Yahweh made to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob regarding the covenant,
when waste his time,
he wouldn't come back. He wouldn't come back. And so the only reason he's coming back is to honor the agreement that he made to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and Yahuda. And that's going to occur on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah. Well, year 6000 Yah is pretty easy to establish when you know when year 4000 Yah is. Yeah, so that's 2033.
Yeah.
All right. That's when the
Yobel year,
which, by the way, happens to be a Yobel year, of course. Now, since it and 5 days later he's going to fulfill Sukkah, which is the beginning of the millennial Shabbat, Sukkah 4-7, camping out with Yahweh for 1,000 years, occurs 5 days later on a natural Shabbat, by the way. All we know for certain is then that Teruah has to be fulfilled sometime between now, since it hasn't been fulfilled yet,
mm-hmm.
and 2033, doesn't it?
Yeah, but you know, I was reading last night, and I was mm-hmm. reading out of your section on Teruah.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read Isaiah, 51:7 or 57:1, mm-hmm. I think,
yep. uh-huh.
he tells some extraordinary things in there about why we, you know, who's going to be saved, how we're going to be saved, and so forth. And it's absolutely guaranteed. So if you go back 7 years from whatever the end date is, mm-hmm. it has to be prior to that, or
yeah.
else he's not fulfilling that promise.
Correct.
So that's a post-event after Teruah, those things will happen. So if you look mm-hmm. at the years, then it's irrational to think, you know, you have to happen before the stuff hits the fan. I mean,
right.
it's just that simple.
Because right.
he's promised to protect those who are like us at this point.
Correct. So my original thought was, and it was back in the day that I had a inflated impression of the value of certain books in the so-called Christian New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've come to realize that more than half the Christian New Testament is the plague of death, everything associated with Paul. That would be all of 13 Paul's letters, plus the book of Acts, plus the book of Hebrews. All of that is just trash. In fact, it's worse than trash. It's poison. It's the plague of death. And I've come to realize that the rest of it was so poorly maintained, and it's already a translation of the Hebrew that was spoken into really inappropriate language, Greek.
Greek and
that it's really, really problematic at best.
Whole chapter, Observation 9, covers
yeah.
that in great detail.
That's right. Observation 9 covers that in great detail. We're going to go back to that before too long and finish our discussion on the history of translations. But in that, I was studying the promises made to the seven groups, the seven ecclesia is how it's written. But it was that had to be a translation of Mikra called out, and it's and in so doing you read about them, and one of the things that it says is that they will be kept out of the time of the great tribulation, and so kept out means it was the Hebrew word for out. So, you know, we realize the tribulation, since 2033 is Yom Kippurim, it's got to be 7 years to get two, three and a half year periods that kept out, we assumed would be, has to occur prior to the fall of 2026 when the tribulation begins.
Not totally, but
not totally, because there are two segments of this time of Jacob's troubles.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob is the synonym for Yisrael. God's only concerned about what happens with Yisrael. He is not concerned with what happens in the United States or Europe or any place else. He's only concerned with what happens to Yisrael. And he has made it clear that it's going to be a bad situation in Yisrael. And saying that the time of Jacob's trouble is that whole seven-year period, but it comes in two phases. There's a first half and a second half. And so it's very possible that God's just going to keep us out of the second half. And it would be to everyone's advantage if we're here longer. You know, as these events that are prophesied come to pass, it gives us the opportunity to wake up a few more people.
Mm-hmm. And pass it on.
Correct.
And have them to be able to pass it on, sure.
Absolutely. So one of the ways that we came to recognize that that this harvest may not occur in 2026,
mm-hmm.
but could occur in 2027, even 2028, is what the timing of the way things are presented in Yeshaya 17. And so what I like to do is turn to Yeshaya 17 now and share that.
Okay.
It begins, a prophetic pronouncement, a masa, regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt. Boy. One of the things I keep on saying about everything that happens in the Middle East is that this incomplete thought that Saddam Hussein was bad, therefore we need to take him out. Assad is bad, therefore we need to take him out. Gaddafi was bad, therefore we need to take him out. That incomplete thought gets people in enormous trouble, because while Assad and Damascus are corrupt, and you've got Hezbollah and headquartered in Damascus, and they're about as bad as you could possibly be,
yeah.
In every one of those instances, those that took control of those countries are far worse than the individual we ousted.
Yes.
So Damascus
with the Ba'ath Party, yeah, than you were with the
then the mullahs out of Tehran controlling Iraq.
Yeah.
Vastly better. Not saying it's good.
No.
But we squandered a million lives.
Yes.
And $6 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
Making a bad situation worse in Iraq. That is unbelievably inexcusable, immoral, irrational. No, there's another word for it. That's stupid.
Yeah, that's unbelief.
Yeah, and we, of course, then praise our military and honor the flag of our country.
Let's have another parade.
Let's have another parade. Let's sing the Star Spangled Banner, put our hands on our heart as we celebrate our stupidity. A prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from among inhabited cities. It is degenerate and unrestrained and shall be abolished. What city was Paul headed to, and where did Paul get all of his great insights? Yeah, absolutely. Damascus.
Yeah,
God is not like Damascus.
Yeah.
You know, for Paul to say that I did this on the way to Damascus to say that I really want to piss off God.
Yeah.
But you got to be...
You know, people who don't know, but Damascus has been around forever. It just has never been destroyed. So that is really perfect. That is really profound.
Yeah, as prophecies go, this is as big... This is a bold prediction. I think those who watch the NFL Network know that on their Sunday morning they have their bold predictions.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bold prediction.
This is a big piece.
This is a big prediction. This is to say that Damascus, now to call Damascus revolting and corrupt, almost every capital city is revolting and corrupt. But to say that the longest continually inhabited city in the world is going to be destroyed at a particular time and for a particular reason. Now, that's bold.
Yeah.
That's a bold prediction.
You've got
to be real confident to lay that one out. And by the way, it didn't even look like that was remotely possible until America invaded Iraq, gave Iraq to Iran, changed the balance of power in the Islamic world between Sunnis and Shias, and started this internal civil war amongst the entire region between Sunnis and Shia. And she shall be totally and actually a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Now, again, that was even unconscionable that a city of Damascus's magnitude could be left as a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. You know, if you look at what we did with the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and then again on Nagasaki, you didn't get a twisted heap of rubble. It just blew everything to the range. It just, mm-hmm. you want a parking lot? But if you look at Homs, if you look at Aleppo, if you look at Mosul,
mm-hmm.
if you look at Fallujah, if you look at what the results of Islamic terrorism combined with the allied militaries on all sides, what you get is Homs.
Mm-hmm.
Homs in Syria is a twisted heap of rubble.
Yeah. Well, the key word being twisted, as you pointed out many times, is rebar was not, steel was not available until the modern era. So
mm-hmm.
you get that twisted look that you wouldn't get in a heap of rubble that you see paintings from years ago where they, hundreds of years ago where they've
been. Yeah. Yeah, Ma'i, which is twisted and tangled. Yeah, you could not have gotten a twisted. There was no. If you look at what the ruins of any ancient city,
it's never
twisted and tangled. It's a heap of rubble.
Yes,
but never twisted and tangled. So without rebar, that's not possible. And if it wasn't for the, in fact, even if you look at pictures of Nazi Germany and the cities that America firebombed.
Well, the bomb.
They were not twisted heaps of rubble. Because what we mostly did is we firebombed them. Yeah. You know, we just white phosphorus. We just burned people up alive. But it burned the buildings down. It didn't blow them apart.
Mm-hmm.
Abandoned and forsaken, estranged, deserted, destroyed, and damned will be the inhabited regions and populated cities of Aurora, the outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon. For there will be roaming animals fighting and militant militias failing miserably, but then there'll be no one to terrorize.
Yeah.
So what God is saying here is that after Damascus is destroyed and becomes a heap of rubble,
what are the jihadists do?
What are the jihadists going to do? They're going to head to Israel, but they're not going to go directly to Israel. They have to stage their attack, and there's two places they'll stage their attack. They're going to stage their attack north of Israel. That's where Hezbollah is going. Hezbollah is going to Lebanon.
Right.
They control Lebanon now. They're going to Lebanon. The Sunni jihadists, they're going to Jordan.
Yeah.
And in Lebanon and in Jordan, they are going to do what Islamic terrorists do. Islamic terrorists kill far more Muslims
than they do
non-Muslims. The reason that there's millions of Muslims trying to migrate out of the Islamic world, the Middle East, from Afghanistan, from Syria, from Iraq, and from Libya, is because Muslims are treating them savagely.
Yes.
Well, God is saying, guess what? They're going to continue to be as they are. And after a while, they will be so well armed and so unstoppable that they're just going to run out of people to terrorize in Jordan and Lebanon. So that's what he says is next going to happen. And if you didn't understand the split between Sunni and Shia Islam, you would never have picked Lebanon and Jordan as the two places they're going to go after they finish their destruction of Damascus. Because, by the way, they don't want Damascus.
No.
What do they want? They want to destroy Israel. Well, the Sunnis are going to go into Jordan, and Hezbollah, Shia, are going to go into Lebanon. God's got this exactly right. But they'll finally, it'd be no one left to terrorize. So the fortified place and the defensive structures will cease to exist on account of the northern kingdom of Ephraim, along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria and Assyria, Aram, for being similarly vehement, burdensome, fanatical, onerous, dim-witted, and enraged. Now, greater Syria is going to fall. Why? Because they're dim-witted, fanatical, and enraged. Boy, is that ever the truth.
That's Islam.
Yeah. The children of Israel, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist. So, Team Islam, 1.5 billion demented individuals strong, is going to seek to destroy a nation that, well, right now, there's maybe 7 million Jews in Israel.
Yeah. At the time, maybe they'll reach 12. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. But let's just say 12, and you've got 1.5 billion Muslims, Israel will continue to exist.
No.
Prophetically declares. Yeah. Now, that's talking about bold predictions. For him to say that Israel is going to continue to exist after the fall of Damascus, what you're saying is two things. One is, guess what? Israel has to be reconstituted. Israel ceased to exist, 600-ish BCE when the Assyrians destroyed Ephraim?
Yeah.
And then Yehuda ceased to exist in 135 when, after the second Roman attack, the Hadrian assault on Rome, on Jerusalem?
Yeah.
So that says that from sometime after, and this is Yisrael, so sometime after 700, 600 BCE or 135, 133 to 135 CE, mm-hmm. when Israel and Yehuda ceased to exist.
Yeah.
That sometime thereafter, something unbelievable, unimaginable had to happen. The country that Rome destroyed, that Assyria destroyed, has to be reconstituted.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's ever happened.
No.
There's 150 countries in the world. I don't think there's a single one of them that can make that claim.
No, I'm going through everything I can think, and I don't think so, no.
You know, that's like saying the United States is going to capitulate, and we're going to give the country back to the Sioux and the Aztec and the Native tribes.
Yeah. That's going to happen.
Yeah. You know, Mexico with the Aztecs and America with the Cheyenne and the Sioux and the Seminole, and we're just going to give them back. That's what that says. Not going to happen. Hasn't happened, but that's what was required for this to happen. And then it's got to say that in spite of all these wars, the War of Independence, 1948,
mm-hmm.
into 49, the Six-Day War, what, 67, the Yom Kippurim War, 74. Well, they must have forgotten that on their ending in sevens. Israel's not going to be destroyed. It's going to continue to exist prophetically, declares Yahweh, the vast array of spiritual envoys. Now we're talking about Teruah here, so let's get to it.
Okay.
So after all of that happens, God's really laying it down on the line. Damascus is going to be a heap of ruins. Greater Syria is going to fall. And then the jihadists are going to go into Lebanon and Jordan. And in spite of what they attempt to do, Israel is going to continue to stand. It will continue to exist. Then he says, and it will actually come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob, that's Israel, shall be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. And the fattest, best protected, and most important place, the waist of his body, shall be leaned, thinned. Well, that's another bold statement. Right. God's saying that after the jihadists go into Lebanon and Jordan, well, what's the world going to think? They just destroyed Damascus. They've taken down the country of Syria. No longer exists.
Yeah.
These jihadists now are in Jordan, and having destroyed Jordan and destroyed Lebanon, what is it that they want next?
Well, they'll tell you.
Yeah, they're telling you now. They want to destroy Israel. They want to destroy Israel. And so what's the world going to do? It's going to capitulate. And this is going to be just like Neville Chamberlain and Adolf Hitler. Oh, he wants the high ground of Czechoslovakia. Oh, let's give it to him.
I'll give you the West Bank.
Yeah, I'll give you the West Bank.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I've already given you Gaza. That really turned out good, didn't it?
Oh, what a hellhole.
So, and by the way, what God is saying here is that what is called the West Bank, it's really Samaria.
Israel.
Yeah, it's the East Bank of Israel. It is it's Samaria.
Yeah.
That God is saying here is that once that's forfeited, and he says that's going to be forfeited, Israel is going to be thinned at the waist. Well, half of Israel's waist was already given away. That's Gaza.
Yeah.
The other half would be what's called the West Bank. And when that is surrendered to attempt to satiate the bloodlust of Muslims, it makes Israel between 5 and 7 miles wide at a place where 70% of the population lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right there between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Now, do you think that you could protect the country, defend the country, if it's 7 miles wide at an exact epicenter of where 70% of your population live, and the people who occupy you on both sides want to destroy you.
No, you theoretically impossible. In the natural, you could not do it. You'd get overrun just like they did in Korea.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the pincher move.
People,
right.
just to pile on bodies of bodies. You can,
right. There is no defensive line. It's impossible to defend. And that's specifically what Yahweh says. Fortunately, we're out of time. But you know what he says next? Because that's when the harvest is going to occur.